Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. This is Way of the Dreamer, the show where we affirm the power of dreaming, coincidence, and imagination. I'm very excited. We have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Imelda Almqvist. She's a shamanic teacher and practitioner, an artist, author of several books, including the new one, North Sea Water in My Veins, in which she really performs an act of cultural soul recovery in trying to bring back the rituals, the traditions, the authentic spiritual life of the Low Countries in an earlier era, but continuing today in the practice of people who are drawn to the old ways. She teaches in Sweden. Her last name is Swedish. Thanks to her husband, I gather it means branch of the elm tree. Her maiden name, I gather, which is Dutch, is Berenson, meaning child of the bear. Is that right?
That is correct as well, yes.
So with your love of languages, Imelda, and you're a fantastic linguist, all the Dutch people I know are fantastic linguists, but you are beyond any of the ones that I've met. You find it significant, as I do, that your names are already so connected with primal elements and with the mythic realm. It's there in your
yes.
names, your two names, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, it's like easy to visualize. I really love my names for that reason.
So there are so many things I want to talk to you about. There are many things I'd like to be instructed by you on, including the Nordic anatomy of soul. I am very interested in what I gather you call in the Netherlands die dubbel, and the nature of the different aspects of soul and energy. I'm very interested in what you have to say about Vanadis and the goddess and the white women in Nordic traditions. But let's start with the new book, because it is so fresh for many of us who don't know very much about the old ways in the Low Countries. I've read a little bit about Nehelinia and the reconstruction of her temple. I know a few of the other goddess names associated with the Low Countries. Tell us about your undertaking. Tell us about what you are trying to do in the new book, which I strongly recommend, whose title is North Sea Water in My Veins. Isn't that beautiful? So what is your ambition with this book?
My ambition was to research whether there was enough material left of the, you know, ancestral indigenous spirituality, the pre-Christian spirituality of the Netherlands, for people to work with and maybe do reconstruction work and reinvention work. So it could be a viable spirituality in its own right. In other words, that people from the Low Countries would not need to borrow a spirituality from like another country or even another continent, which has become the standard practice. And the book came about because one of my students asked me to write that book, saying that such a book doesn't exist. You know, you speak many languages, you've written other books, you know how to do research. Why don't you write the missing book? That's how it all started.
Let me explain to people that one of the distinctions of this book is it really has a fantastic guide, a sort of biographical guide to the old ones, the gods, the spirits, with all the names that you could find relevant to the area of culture and geography you're covering, and notes on all of them. I mean, this is not perhaps the fastest read in the book. The book is very well written, and there are passages which are very beautiful and also contain a wealth of personal experience. And part of the great value of this book is simply that you give us, laid out, name by name, by name, by name, by name, all these names of the old ones, of the Aesir, and the Dísir, as those names apply to the Low Countries. And this required a vast amount of work. I know you found sources that most of us don't know exist. You read them in many languages. You walked the land. Let me just say to everybody that another of your distinctions, Imelda, from my point of view, and if you don't use the phrase, I'm going to give it to you, is that you are, from my point of view, a dream archaeologist. By that,
oh, wow, that's beautiful.
Well, you've now got it. You can wear it around your neck with pride or put it on your head like a tiara. You're a dream archaeologist, by which I mean you're someone who melds, brings together the gifts of direct experience, whether it's through dreaming, intuition, meditating with the land, sitting with the land, with scholarship and science and detective work. And for the dream archaeologist, sometimes the first lead is given by something you find in a document, in a book, in a saga, in an old story, and then you follow it up, well, let's say, by shamanic journeying, by going to the site, by sitting with the land. And sometimes it comes the other way around. With me, it often comes the other way around. I dream something. I mean, I dream a great deal. And the dream guides my research. I do the research assignment. And though I'm a lazy linguist compared to you, it sometimes compelled me to learn languages I would never thought of studying otherwise, to learn an archaic form of the Mohawk Indian language, an archaic form
wow.
of the Huron-Wendat language, because in those dreams of an ancient woman of power, it was not like a New Age bubble where you sort of get everything all at once. It required work. It was clear that the person in contact with me required me to enter her world, enter her culture deeply. So it became what you call in your book an exercise in time travel, which you recommend to those of us who want to find the authentic living traditions of the past. So talk about how you follow what you call spiritual investigation. That's one of the phrases that you use of these things, and bring together direct experience with scholarship.
Yeah, I think it's very much as you just say, because I am a teacher, and I'm primarily a teacher of, you know, Nordic and Old Norse traditions. And in the world, on like popular blogs and in popular, you know, mythology books, there's a lot of misinformation out there that keeps on being circling and being regurgitated. So I'm a stickler for historical accuracy. I feel I fail my students as a teacher if I cannot tell them, you know, what things were really like at a certain time period, and to make a distinction between a kind of like fantasy we see on TV maybe in certain TV shows and, you know, what things were actually like in the Old Norse period. But I also sort of feel that A, not everything has been preserved, so we don't have like a full set of material. In a way, I think that that is the blessing, because it invites us to engage with the material and form a direct relationship, you know, with the deities and the guardian beings and the land we are on, all of the things you just mentioned. So for me, these two things need to go hand in hand, because if we were to only practice a tradition as it was practiced in Northern Europe over a millennium ago, we would be living in the past. You know, like people who have the fantasies of being Vikings again. Like, we cannot do that. We cannot go and live in the 9th century. But at the same time, we can take the wonderful material we have. We can make sure we're well informed. And then we can build a personal relationship to, you know, the key beings, the deities. We can pay close attention to our dreams. We can sit out on grave mounds or anywhere else. And then when we put that together, that's where the material comes to life. I think it allows for the richest experience.
One of the things that streams through your book very beautifully and passionately is a sense of connection with the land, and above all, of course, with the water, because you remind us low countries are really low. You remind us that 27% of the Netherlands is below sea level. I mean, I used to feel that when I taught in Amsterdam and other places in the Netherlands. I'd sometimes dream that I was underwater, but breathing perfectly fine. So a lot of your book, and it's in the title too, a lot of your book celebrates the connection with water. Spirits of water. I picture, as I read you, these islands in the midst of a lake or a swamp or in the sea, where the goddess or the white woman or the ancient mother has her place, her special place. And anybody reading you and following the leads that you give is going to want to connect more closely with the land and the water. And you give practices, you give activities you suggest people should do, might do, to deepen this connection. Tell us how you feel that your approach here, and we'll come later to your courses on Sesra and seership and sacred art and all of that, but tell us, thinking about this book right now, what do you want people to bring from it for their current lives? What do you most want people to take from your book?
What I hope people will take from this book is inspiration. I also decided to write it in English to make it available to, there's so many people out there, you know, Canada, New Zealand, US, etc. cetera, Australia, who have Dutch Germanic ancestry, but they have lost the ability to speak Dutch. So this material is completely not available to them unless someone translates it in English. Some people in the Netherlands were a bit upset. They said, like, why didn't you write it in Dutch? It's more convenient. I said, well, English is sort of like the informal, unofficial second language of the Netherlands, and everyone in the Netherlands under the age of 90 speaks fantastic English, so I think I've made the right choice. So, like, to make the material accessible, to show people there is an alternative to, say, thinking you have to go to maybe Peru or, you know, like, borrow spiritual teachings from Native Americans, because we also have the issue of counter-cultural appropriation. So, like, big questions are being asked about if that is the right way to go, and people are asked to reflect on that by the elders of those traditions. So what I'm trying to offer is offer the material in English. I've translated it all to the best of my ability for whatever that is worth. And I want to sort of show people there is enough to work with here in our own country. And not only that, the material we work with in the Low Countries, like you just say, it's all permeated by water, because this is land reclaimed from the sea. Like, my mother lives in a part of the Netherlands that's below sea level. So, like, water is everywhere. And then it makes much more sense to form a relationship with water, with the spirit of water, with the way that water has shaped the land, with, you know, all the tales and folklore we have about water spirits. And it's like a wealth of material there, and it's all about, like, local beings and sort of, you know, like, deities of the Netherlands. And I think many people like maybe spiritual and, you know, like, go on courses with various teachers. But I think many people maybe don't realize how much material is still available to us. Like, if you just scratch below the surface, like, how much has been preserved and it's kind of dormant under the veneer of the contemporary culture. So I want to issue a really big invitation for people to say, you know, like, you know, at least take some time out of your schedule to really connect with your ancestors and your ancestors of place, and sort of educate yourself about what the ancestral spirituality was of your country, of, you know, either origin or ancestral origin. That's the invitation.
That's right. I think it will be inspiring to people who may come from, who may have a different ancestry, or who think they have a different ancestry. And after all, we're all connected. But it is a model for, you know, what Diane Gages call again cultural soul recovery, bringing back authentic traditions, rituals, and approaches from the old ones, going through, you know, forgetting all the new age, you know, sham stuff, getting to the sources as we have them, and exploring them directly. You talk about some of your own dreams and visions, by the way. I smiled when I saw you talking about dreaming since childhood of being a forest witch in Sweden. And I guess, in a sense, you are that today, right? And then you talk about, you know, dreaming the Milky Way as a path of souls or something like that. And then you talk about having a vision of Holla, Frau Holla. I think it was when you were in the United States, had a connection with the bird people. So
you
reveal to us, in addition to sitting with the land and walking these special places, you show us that you're a dreamer, you're a visionary, and that's part of your way of knowing. Talk to me a little bit more about that. What role does dreaming and visioning play in your life?
Well, I would say it is almost central to everything I do. Like, if I had to put it in just keywords, I would say the historical accuracy piece I already talked about, and then after that it's dreaming. So for me, many things, you know, they either start with dreams, like very often something comes to me in a dream, and then I have to do research. I remember having a dream once where I called Hebrew words, and then I had to go and talk to Hebrew friends about what those words meant, and that was a whole journey of discovery that opened up. And Hebrew is not one of my languages. I don't actually speak it. And also in dreams, often, you know, I get these glimpses, and I think everyone gets these glimpses. That's why it's so important to keep a dream journal. But also, dreaming, I find, is location-based. When I teach in the United States, I tend to have different dreams where I'm dreaming with the, you know, the local spirits of the land and the beings that are prominent there. But also about, you know, I dream about the things that my Dutch and even Swedish ancestors have done in the U.S. So not all of these dreams are comfortable. But for me, dreaming is a very direct way of being in communication with what is invisible to us in everyday life, but very, very present nonetheless, and in a way also very, very timeless. You know, like these are really like the big things, the big beings, the deities, the ancestors of place, and indeed the night sky. And the stories are ancestors saw in the night sky, and what that teaches us about our own sort of cultural and spiritual practices.
Very well said, and very mobilizing for people. I am convinced, as you know, that dreaming is perhaps our easiest way of access to the sacred, and that through the window of dreams, through the doorway of dreams, the guides, the teachers, and the ancestors who are looking for us will appear, and they'll change costumes depending on our level of understanding and perception, and perhaps they'll change identity, as you say, depending where in the world and the worlds we are traveling. And it's going on every night, and it's very sad that so many people are not open to it, but some of us, like you and me, are trying to change that, and I think we're having some effect. And your book,
I think we are. We are.
Yes, I think we are. I mean, when people say, why are things so bad, I say, well, stop talking like that. Yeah, the world's been going through a dream drought, but you know what? We're changing it. We're going to go on changing it, because it puts people back in touch with soul. It puts them in touch with the ancestors who are trying to talk to them. It opens paths to healing. And it's the common property of all humans. I mean, it's absolutely egalitarian in the sense we all have access to the material if we just open up.
Exactly. And it also, it doesn't involve what is a big issue at the moment, that like theft from another culture, because our dreams are truly our own. They are tailor-made for us by, you know, the Lord and Lady of Dreams and the spirits of dreams and our ancestors and all the beings that appear. And another thing I would add to what you just said is that I find dream intentions incredibly helpful as well. I use that a lot with students, no matter like where in the world I teach or what I'm teaching. Doesn't matter if it's sacred art or if it's Seder or whatever. But I nearly always finish the day with a dream intention. I set the students a dream intention, and then I ask them to bring their dreams the next morning. And then you also have a group of people who are starting off with the same dream intention. And then when you hear all the dreams shared, you know, you can start piecing it together. And often one person's dream clarifies something that happens in another person's dream, or a person's dream ends, but then another person in the room has the continuation of the story. And there is something, and I'm sure you do this all the time, but there is something mind-blowing about, like, when you dream collectively, how the kind of fabric of reality and also of other worlds becomes visible.
Yes, and I think one of the things that you're touching on is that, although dreams are individual and unique, and when you get into specifics, I mean, your dream is not the same as anybody else's, because your snake is not exactly anybody else's, yet it does reflect a universal pattern and archetype, and we can see something of ourselves in your dream. But having said that, dreaming is social as well as individual, and when you have a spirited community who are connected, they will start dreaming together, and you can set this up as a formal intention. I'm sure you do it when you lead shamanic journey and that kind of thing. You'll have people journeying with a common agenda and maybe a common itinerary and a common map. But it goes on spontaneously, too, between people who are connected. I mean, I work with webs of hundreds of dreamers who are taking my courses, and we notice as things go along effortlessly, even before we make it an assignment, that they're entering a web of dreaming in a very benign and positive sense, with overlapping symbols, overlapping experiences, and sometimes full interaction in very interesting places. And of course, that brings back first-hand confirmation of the objective reality of experience in other orders of reality, which is something, again, we need to have, because people are sometimes unclear about the fact that behind the curtain of the world, there are other worlds. As I was reading you again this morning, getting ready for the interview, I was thinking about, you know, how the 12, is it 12 worlds of the Norse mythology, 12 worlds
of
Yggdrasil? I'm thinking, what a model for the multidimensional universe that is, as we understand it today, both in the language of science, and in the popular culture, you know, the Marvel multiverse and all this sort of stuff, which is actually tried to appropriate the Norse deities also. But there is there, right there in the mythology, there is a model for how things work in the many worlds, which when you enter it with a freshness of openness to direct experience, is actually really fascinating to explore.
I think it is fascinating, and you only need to compare it with experience of shamanic journeying or, you know, years of keeping a dream journal to know that, of course, there are many more than 12 worlds, and that is what the Scandinavian material ultimately teaches. But you're right, there is an idea out there which is very, very deeply cemented into the popular minds and popular blogs on the internet that there are the 9 worlds of Norse mythology. And that's simply not correct. People only need to read the Poetic Edda or the Prose Edda, the two big sacred texts of, the Nordic traditions. And then we find that in one of the texts, the Völuspá, that's where the vulva, the primordial vulva, speaks. And she talks about the 9 worlds that existed before the present universe. She's talking about 9 worlds, but like they existed before what we currently have. And it probably still exists as like multi-dimensional, you know, like other dimensions. Sorry, I should wrap it up.
We're having a fascinating conversation, and our wonderful guest is Imelda Allen-Kvist. Her new book is North Sea Water in My Veins. What is your website, Imelda?
It is www.shaman-painter-healer.co.uk.
All right, that's a bit of a mouthful. We'll have it again, and we'll post it afterwards. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Imelda. I'm going to ask her to start talking about the many aspects of soul and the double or doppelganger that we learn about in the Norse tradition. She'll listen to The Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Back after the break.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Welcome back. This is Robert Moss. This is Way of the Dreamer. Pop over to mossdreams.com, my website, and see some of the online courses and trainings and productions that I'm involved in. And Imelda Almqvist, I mean, her new book is North Sea Water in My Veins. It is a model for intelligent cultural soul recovery, combining ways of direct experience with the scholarship and detective work and philology, the study of language that is required. We've used the word shamanic once or twice as an adjective, Imelda. I know that you draw pause as I do when I see the way that the word shamanism is bandied about in our culture. Shamanic as an adjective is fine. Of course, shamanic peoples don't have any isms. It's not part of their way of approaching things. In Mongolia and Siberia, the words for the body of knowledge have nothing to do with ism. They mean the stories or the tellings. And you and I both appreciate how important a story or a telling is to this part. Mm. In North America, where I live, I mean, I love this. The word, in many indigenous peoples, the word that we translate as shaman actually means dreamer. in Mohawk, which, as I said, I had to learn because of my dreams, it's Radzedzot. It means dreamer. It means one who dreams a lot, one who can enter the dream world at will, one who can guide souls through dreaming. And it's the same all across the continent, British Columbia, the Dene Zah, or Beaver Indians. Their word for shaman is Natchin, which means dreamer. So in North America, where I live, though of course I'm originally Australian and very European in some ways too, it's very clear to me. Dreaming is the heart of the matter. It doesn't require hallucinogens. It doesn't require drugs. The rituals that you do had better be the right ones, and they better be founded on some, you know, authentic understanding. And I think you feel the same way. It's a path of direct experience. At the heart of it is dreaming. And unfortunately, people resort to all sorts of artificial means of shifting consciousness because they don't dream strong anymore. That's a pity.
No, and also our culture doesn't value dreams. It often speaks of dreams as like sort of, you know, a fantasy. And, you know, you'll tell children, oh, it wasn't real when they wake up. That's quite normal in our culture. That's not the right way to...
We're trying to change that. I mean, possibly, just to speak about to that point for 1 second, possibly the most important thing I've personally contributed so far is a simple four-step process for sharing and talking about dreams and stories. You can do in a few minutes. It's fun. It raises energy. You can get feedback in a non-authoritarian, non-intrusive way, and you're guided towards healing and creative action all in a few minutes. Our society lacks something that makes the sharing of dreams rewarding, socially rewarding. So it's something you want to do, and you're not just throwing it out there not knowing what people will say. People know how to proceed. And even if they don't have an opinion about your dream, that doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it's your opinion that matters. They can help you to get through. All right, I want to move on to something that you can teach me and all of us a great deal about, and that absolutely fascinates me, which is the way that in Norse tradition, we're going Norse now, different aspects of soul, energy, the double, are understood and presented. I shared a story with you privately before this about one night when a man I knew who'd been invited to come to my house turned up before his body did. He turned up during the night like a ghost. And I looked at him and I said, it's too early, Fred. You're not due yet. You're coming tomorrow or the day after. Go away. I'm not ready to entertain you yet. And I thought afterwards, is there a sort of Norse model for this? Is this the Thulja, which means follower, but it sometimes travels ahead? Talk to us a little bit about what you can tell us about how different aspects of the double, the energy body, soul, and spirit, are understood in Norse tradition.
Yes, well, I would say that in the case of Fred, we're not talking about the Thulja, because the Thulja is like a personal following spirit who's also other than the person being followed, so to speak. So I wouldn't use the word Thulja for that.
Okay.
But with Fred, I would be looking at what we call the hammer. And the word hammer, which is Old Norse, it means that we have an energetic body as well, like in addition to our physical body. And then what we read in the Norse sagas and the stories is that people who have training in magic can like work with that actively and like, you know, they can like bilocate and send it on errands and things like that. But also when people are, you know, it can sometimes happen when they're dreaming. More commonly, it happens when people are in crisis, like on the battlefield, or maybe when they're very ill and death draws close. We then see that their energy body is like on the move, and other people see it, and they see it in other places than where the person physically is. And the Old Norse for that is the hammer. But there are like many other, you know, words as well that all refer to slightly different like manifestations of that, and ultimately it is connected, I would say.
I find this fascinating. I mean, it's one of my favorite subjects, the double in all its forms, including the dream double, including the versions of ourselves who seem to roam around with or without our full consciousness in different realities. For example, Imelda, I receive every day at least 3 or 4 detailed reports of what I am supposed to be doing in other people's dreams. Some days it's as many as 30 or 40, and I'm not just saying reports would say, I saw you in a dream, Robert. I'm saying, talking about reports in which people say, Robert, you gave that lecture and you said such and such and such and such, or you led that ritual and we did such and such and such and such, or we had dinner in that restaurant and here's what we had. I mean, detailed reports. And I'm open to the, of course, that they might be projection in some cases, you know, what part of you is like Robert. But in some of them, I'm perfectly prepared to accept that we, in this case, I, am traveling around, visiting more than one place at the same time in different subtle energy bodies that are active in dreams. Of course, these things show up in our waking perception as well. It's just an endlessly fascinating subject to me. And I read you saying either here or in one of your curriculum descriptions, that in the Norse belief, we have 4, 7, or 9 significant aspects of consciousness and energy bodies. And this is right up there with Egypt. It's right up there with the Neoplatonists. It's right up there with some Eastern ways of looking at these things. But for most of us in modern Western society, our anatomy of soul and spirit is very impoverished. If people believe there's something beyond the body and brain, it's just the body and the soul. They don't understand these different layers of consciousness and energy bodies. So tell us something more about what we can learn from Norse tradition as interpreted by you.
Sure. Well, one thing we could say is that in the Old Norse tradition, the what they call the lik, which is like the physical body, is also a part of our soul. It's only one part of our soul, and then there are like many others. So there is a kind of focus away from the physical body, as it were, because there are like many other, you know, aspects of us. But I find it interesting that the physical body is seen as a part of our soul, not as separate from our soul. Another really big one is the hugger, and that connects to the cognitive mind. And people may know that Odin has two ravens, Hugin and Munin, and Hugin is sort of named for the huger. And it's the huger in Old Norse is like our cognitive force, our intellect, you know, like where we use our waking mind. And the huger is then also, it's another energy body. We use it a bit different from the hammer, but it's very much related to our personal will and using our cognition to shape something. So, for instance, I have an elderly mother in the Netherlands who isn't very well at the moment. So if I want to send a part of me on a mission to go check on her or keep her company without my leak, my physical body traveling, work with the huger and create a being that visits my mother in the Netherlands and reports back.
We're talking with Imelda Almqvist. Isn't it fascinating stuff? So perhaps we'll learn more about how you might be able to travel with the flying ability and keen eyesight of the raven or maybe another bird to visit someone at a distance or scout out something you need to know about. We'll be back after the break. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Back. This is Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our quite wonderful guest is Imelda Almqvist, shamanic teacher and practitioner, also not only a wonderful artist, but someone who teaches sacred art. Go look for her online, Imelda Almqvist, and look for this new book, North Sea Water in My Veins. She was talking about Hugin and Munin, the eyes of Odin, and the ravens that go and scout things out. Imelda, I read somewhere that Odin's always concerned that his ravens will come back, but he's more worried about Munin. He's more worried that Munin might not come back.
some of the other one won't come back. Have I got that right? Do you know anything about that? Why would he be
Yes, I think it is right. And the thing to remember, just as I said, Hüger relates, you know, Hügien comes from Hüger, like the waking mind, or, you know, or like personal cognition. But Münin is related, name comes from Mini, and Mini is memory, and that's also
yes.
seen as part of the anatomy of soul. So if Münin would not come back, we would lose our memory. And if we lose our personal memory, and maybe also our ancestral memory, then we no longer know who we are, and we also lose, you know, touch with, you know, all we ever were before. Like, memory is sort of what links all of these things together. Like, remembering dreams, you know, helps us bring into this world what we experienced in the dream world. So that's what I think that means. It means, like, losing memory as the clue that holds it all together.
Thank you for that wonderfully concise and eloquent explanation of why memory might be more important than thought as we translate those terms. I must say, over the years, Imelda, with far less knowledge about the depths of the tradition than you have, I've encouraged people many times to make journeys to scout out the possible future with the aid of two ravens. I mean, borrowing from the Odin story. We haven't necessarily spent time on the Odin story other than to say you have two ravens available. And the very first time I led this for a large group, we were given an assignment, or I think we were working with partners. I was given a personal assignment to check out what was going to happen at a certain fish restaurant next Tuesday. I mean, it's as specific as that. And I tell myself the ravens will be available. It wasn't the first time that I found the ravens available to me in this kind of journeying. And I get to the restaurant, and I see the scene inside pretty clearly, but one of the ravens wants to go out the back where there are fish guts, fish offal in barrels. It stinks. And the raven is hungry, plunges his head into the fish guts, and he's lost for a while. It was so vivid, so funny, so, you know, hilariously funny, that it just felt absolutely authentic. So I came back with the sight and impressions of one raven, but the other one had been too busy eating fish guts. I found that very funny. That's very authentic, because where do we get the word ravenous from in English? By the way,
exactly.
There's some funny moments in your book, and they're often when you just throw in a Dutch phrase. Your English is wonderful, but you'll throw in a Dutch phrase just to sort of remind us that you're Dutch and that there are Dutch people reading it. You talk about a monkey sandwich story?
Yes.
And when I read you saying that, I to borrow another Dutch phrase you introduced me to, I found myself laughing in my fist. Laughing in my fist. I mean, it's the wonderful phrases which we really need to, you know, domesticate in the English language, because they're too good to leave to the Dutch alone. So you did bring us a couple of funny phrases, you know, from the Dutch linguistic treasury. Thank you.
Yeah, there is a glossary in the book with Dutch phrases. Another one will be the Monday morning monster, you know, when you return to work after the weekend and nothing goes right and everyone has a headache. The Monday morning monster is responsible for that. Let's say that.
You know, with your command of languages, I guess you're up to about 20 languages now. I know only one person in my life who has exceeded that. He was my close friend in school. He was, like you, one of those natural polylinguists. Last time I saw him was 10 years ago. He was up to 32, and it was at government translator level. He'd been the official government translator in Mandarin, in Russian, in Arabic, and so on. I mean, and he's a savant, like you, has a wonderful mind, wonderful cognitive ability. It's just incredibly good. I love the play of words, but like most Anglos, I'm a lazy linguist, so I'm forever in the situation where I pick up these really interesting phrases from my dreams, sometimes from languages that I know, sometimes from languages I know a little bit about, sometimes from languages I have to identify. That's how it started with the Mohawk language, so I had a clue because of geography where it might be coming from. And then I do my research, but generally I try to avoid having to learn the language. After I learned Mohawk with native speakers, back in the days there were no dictionaries, no grammars, it was also old Roniode material and old cassette tapes and live connection, and the living Mohawks would say, Robert, you're very hard to understand. Not just your Anglo-Australian accent, but you're talking to us the way we talked 300 years ago. It's like trying to understand Shakespeare. It's really difficult. But, you know, normally, unlike you, I won't undergo the discipline and the work of having to learn the whole language. So I have to make do with what I've got.
You know, your adventures in language, Imelda, could make you, you're a very good writer, but they could make you an extraordinary writer. I'm thinking about Joseph Conrad, whom language was the, English was the third language. And when he wrote English, he changed the way that we all speak and read it. Because he imported into the English language a certain tilt, a certain quality of difference, a certain freshness, so that some of Conrad's writing of his third language actually shaped the way the language is written and used. And you know, you have that kind of ability. I just want to say that because I greatly admire goodly speech, as the Celts call it.
Yeah, but I think the beauty of knowing different languages is I use it all the time. If I get stuck in one language, I just run a search in another language. Or even standing at a bus stop, if I have some dead time and my thoughts are just going. And if there's something I get stuck on, I think, okay, how does it run in Dutch? How does it run in Finnish? How does it run in Russian? How does it run in Swedish? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And very often, if I cannot resolve it in, say, Dutch or English or whatever language I'm in, if you switch to another language, all of a sudden there is a snippet. And then with that snippet, you can go deeper into research. And I think that's what I absolutely love about having access to more languages. Like you say, it gives a fresh perspective. It turns something upside down. Or sometimes in another language, say in some sort of Slavic languages, things have been preserved that have been lost in contemporary, like, Western European languages. So sometimes you need to go into, like, Russian or languages like that. And then, you know, or sometimes it's the connotations that are still there. It's and that's also why, you know, being a translator is a very hard job because, you know, you're either going to be very true to what you're translating but maybe end up with a boring translation, or you're going to give a creative translation but then people in the know are going to challenge you and say you got too far away from the original. So being a translator is an incredibly creative job. It's a talent.
I was just thinking about the destiny of your book. There's a Norse word for destiny, isn't there? I mean, there are several Norse words for destiny, but I think about the destiny of this new book. Amongst people of Dutch heritage or of Dutch connection all over the world, because there are so many of them everywhere, I mean, not just South Africa and so on, but as you know, I mean, there are so many people of Dutch extraction in the United States, including where I live. I mean, I live in Albany, which is originally a Dutch city, Port Orange. It was originally a Dutch city. So the city I live in is full of Dutch names. We have a tulip festival. It's paired with, I think it's Leiden. And so there are lots of people of Dutch extraction in the country where I live, the United States. People feel a kind of longing, I mean, a kind of yearning, the Welsh say, for places of origin of the ancestors. I have the feeling that your book might have an interesting destiny with them, and of course not just with people who are on that track. I mean, I feel a huge Dutch connection in my life, and I grew up with the memories of a Royal Air Force pilot who was shot down over the Netherlands in during the Second World War. So I've had that sense of connection with the Netherlands for a long time. All right, we have to take another pause. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. We have so much we can talk about with Imelda Almquist. We'll continue this adventure in a moment.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
I'm having a wonderful time. I think you are too, aren't you, with Imelda Almquist. Her new book is North Sea Water in My Veins. I said to Imelda for part of this last segment, I just want to open the dikes and just let scream through you whatever wants to come. But before we do that, I want to introduce one more very big subject, which is the subject of weird, W-Y-R-D. Imelda, I'm of Scottish extraction on my father's side, though before they were Scots, they came from Scandinavia. And in Scotland, until relatively recently, it was very bad not to be weird. Weirdless, to be without weird, was bad fortune. Mm. You know, the lucky people were the weird ones, spelt the way the English usually spell it. Tell us a little bit about weird, the web of weird, and pulling the threads of weird.
Sure.
All of that.
Well, the word weird comes from Old English, the way you spell it, you know, like W-Y-R-D. That comes from the time of Beowulf. It doesn't actually come from Scandinavia, or I mean, it originates in Scandinavia, but it becomes that in Old English. But
right.
In Old Norse, the original word is Urder, and Urder is the name of the oldest Norn, if you talk about the three Norns, Urd, Skuld, and Verdandi. And Urder is related to the word for origin. And also then there's like the well of origin, that like, you know, everything that exists in the world, it rises from Urdabrunner, from the well of origin, and it comes into being and it comes into existence. But then also it is said that those three Norns, Urd, Skuld, and Verdandi, allocate fate to all beings, not just human beings, but also to like animals and lands and, you know, other beings, that, you know, for everything to have a lifespan here on the planet, it needs to be fated. Like, to not have a fate is a terrible fate, because it means you're disconnected from all other beings. You're kind of like cut off from the web of life. So you need to be fated. Like, the Norns need to allocate you a fate for you to be in the world at all.
All right. I'm going to invite you, Imelda, to take the conversation in any direction that appeals to you right now. What would you most like to talk about at this point?
I think maybe I would like to speak a bit about the Dutch deities that I introduce in my book. And,
yes.
You know, when I went to school in the Netherlands, of course, I had history lessons. It's on the curriculum. And, you know, I learned about an awful lot of wars that play out. But I never learned that at some point there was a temple to an ancient goddess called Nehalennia, and it's near Domburg in the province of Zeeland in the southern western, like on the coast of the Netherlands. But there was a really big storm, and it sort of threw up fragments of a temple to this ancient goddess Nehalennia. And, you know, that's because history you don't learn in Dutch schools. And then people have done the work of reconstructing that, and they have, like, rebuilt that temple as far as they were able to. And now in Domburg, in the province of Zeeland, there is a temple to Nehalennia again, where people can go and pay their respects and sort of, you know, connect to Nehalennia as one of the kind of archetypal goddesses of the Netherlands, who is a goddess of, like, seafaring, very much connected to water. She's also connected to home and hearth and keeping people safe. And I just find it extraordinary that I spent years learning about wars, but I never actually learned about this ancient temple of an indigenous Dutch goddess, like being exposed by a very bad storm. So I just find that fascinating. And then, of course, you know, we have other goddesses as well. So I could just mean there are directories in the book, as you said earlier, so there are many names people can work with and do reconstruction work with. But I just want to mention Baduhenna, who is kind of like a war goddess. You talked about Odin's ravens earlier. She, you know, can take the form of a raven. When I dream of her, she takes the form of a raven and a bird. And, you know, she would sort of, you know, hover over the battlefields. And she's one of these goddesses you don't want to mess with. Then we also have Ludana, and we have Tamvana. And Tamvana is very much a goddess who is a witch. She's from the eastern part of the Netherlands, like the province of Drenthe. And she is said to have a castle in the clouds. She's a psychopomp, And also, you know, she works with children. Like, the only place where she still appears in Dutch culture is, like, in a children's song about her, where she lives in a pink castle in the clouds. She has, like, a dog. And, you know, really, when you hear the whole song, it's about, like, psychopomp work, that she does the work of accompanying souls that are making a transition between the worlds. And then, you know, the final one I mentioned was the goddess Ludana, who's also very much related to water and to fishing. And like Nahelenia, she has a connection to water, but in a slightly different way. And we were also saying earlier how in the Netherlands, like, everything leads back to water because it's land reclaimed from the sea, and the sea is always trying to claim it back, which is why we have dikes and other sort of, you know, engineering going on. So in... if you're from that part of the world, as I am, I think it makes so much sense to work with these deities who are native to the Low Countries, who have that very, very deep connection to water. So I'd just like to invite, if people are of Dutch ancestry or extraction, I just want to invite people to, like, work with that, like, do your own dreaming or do your own shamanic journeys and see what these deities can tell you and how they can be active in your life.
What a beautiful introduction to some of the rich array of goddess figures, goddess names from this area. I've done some work with Sequana, who's mentioned briefly in your book, who's the goddess of the River Seine, whose name is translated by some of the scholars as the fast-flowing one. And she has an aspect which I don't think I saw mentioned in your book in relation to the other goddesses you were named. She's a goddess of dreams. I mean, people practice dream incubation at her sacred precinct, which is at the source of the River Seine. And we have the votive offerings. We have a lot of evidence about that. So when I've introduced people to Sequana, we've sung a river song. It's not an old Celtic river song, really, but it's an old song which we've adapted to Sequana's cult as we practice it. And we've practiced a form of dream incubation, I mean, on the imaginal level, not altogether dissimilar from what we might do with an Asclepian meditation. I'm just wondering, I mean, any of the goddesses you mentioned that are connected with water, it'd be a natural connection of them also to be deities of dreams, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that possibly be part of the cult?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely, because, like, in my book you may have seen that I've included a summary of the runes, like the Frisian runes. Like, in Scandinavia I teach the runes of the Elder Futhark, but myself I work with the Frisian runes as well, being Dutch. And then I have said throughout the book several times that if there is, like, one rune that would sum up the Netherlands, or would be archetypal for the Netherlands, it would be rune Lagu, or Lagus, which is the rune of water. Because that's very much where we find dreaming, you know. So yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing people can do. People could familiarize themselves with the Frisian runes and start working with them. And then rune Lagus, the water rune, is a brilliant rune to work with if you or about your Dutch ancestry and, you know, the place that you or your ancestors came from.
So much more to explore, Imelda. I hope people will go and find you online, look at your courses. Look at the new book, North Sea Water in My Veins, and at the other books about imagination and shamanic approaches to things. As you hear, Imelda is an inspired and inspiring teacher, lives deep, dreams deep, and we'll be back really to say dankjewel after the break. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Noss.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You've been listening to The Way of the Dream with Robert Moss with our fantastic guest, Imelda Almqvist. I hope you're streaming along with North Sea water and the rivers and the wells and the lakes that she mentioned. Thank you so much for joining me with your dream of restoring authentic traditions of the North and the Low Countries, Imelda. You're a wonderful, wonderful guest and a wonderful, wonderful teacher and artist.
Well, you are a wonderful host, and I feel most honored to be here, and it's been a delight to have a conversation with you. So thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you, Val, and may your best dreams come true.